From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Call it XLV 45, the showdown in Dallas or North Texas or Arlington or whatever, but it's still the Super Bowl to me. Ahead on Only a Game, a preview from Dallas, and Only a Game's Karen Given explores whether the big game will generate an estimated $600 million. Also, a new chronicle of Bobby Fischer's fall from chess mastery to the brink of insanity. Also ahead, the 17th annual installment of Super Bowl Haiku.
Hype, kickoff, ads, halftime, ads, final gun, ads.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Super Bowl will be played in Arlington tomorrow, but the weather in North Texas has been getting nearly as much attention as the game itself. The region has been hit with unusually severe winter storms, and yesterday, snow and ice fell from the roof of Cowboys Stadium and injured several people. Some were taken to the hospital. Players and fans will not have to deal with the elements during the game itself. Cowboys Stadium has a retractable roof. Joining me now from Dallas to discuss Super Bowl XLV is Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, tomorrow's big game will feature Pittsburgh and Green Bay. Both teams have been saying and doing their pre-Super Bowlish things. What has caught your attention?
Yeah, even at the elite level, the NFL, of course, the highest level of football, the Super Bowl is the highest game played, and yet both coaches are doing juvenile high school level games of gotcha. You got the Steelers are trying to convince us that maybe Marquise Pouncey, their Pro Bowl center, will play on Sunday, and he's not going to play. He's got a high ankle sprain at best, possibly a broken bone. At worst, he's not playing, but they won't say that. Then the Packers respond with their own little mini controversy by saying Donald Driver, their number two receiver, missed practice Friday, but we think he'll play Sunday, but he did miss practice Friday. The whole thing's a bunch of bunk. He's fine. He's playing. Marquise Pouncey's not fine. He's not playing. I don't know why we need the cloak and dagger.
Well, we need the cloak and dagger, I guess, to distract us from such things as reporters dressed as superheroes on media day, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and we had one reporter running around, this is a woman, to various players saying, I'm going to adopt you, and when I adopt you, you can call me Mama. So let's start right now. Call me Mama. And this whole thing was taking place on tape, on camera. And she ran from player to player demanding they call her Mama, and it actually got dumber from there, if you can believe it.
It sounds like the Super Bowl to me. I'm going to ask you to step out of your sports shoes for just a moment and ask you to be a writer of travel agency brochures. For those who have never attended America's Week of Weeks, how would you describe overall the Super Bowl experience?
Expensive. I guess if I'm a travel agent writer, I'm only sending this to people who have the new level of iPad and the new level of whatever the new technology is, because if you're still using a plain old PC, you can't afford to be here. The tickets are expensive, but I'm not even talking about the tickets. Like, they talk about the Super Bowl as a big party atmosphere, and there's all these parties, and Playboy Playmates are at parties here and there. And it's true. It all happens around Dallas. It's exorbitant. But you can't go unless you've got just tons of money. You've got to have the kind of money where you make it rain. But if you want to make it rain, you're an idiot, and you wouldn't be in Pittsburgh in the first place or in Dallas.
You don't really enjoy covering the Super Bowl, do you?
Did that come through a little bit? I liked my first year. You know, it's one of those things you want to cover it because everyone does it, and you want to say you've done it. And now I've done it, and I kind of wish they wouldn't even play the Super Bowl anymore. I wish they'd go from the AFC and the NFC title games and then just give us some bullcrud BCS national champion. Here's your champion this year. The computer says it's Green Bay. That's fine with me. This whole week in Dallas or wherever we go, ducking idiots asking players to call me Mama, I could do without this.
However, your feelings notwithstanding, I understand there will actually be a football game tomorrow, so you better tell us who's going to win Super Bowl XLV.
Yeah, I'm going to break this down for you. I am a football writer, and so I'm going to break this down for you like this. The Pittsburgh Steelers don't lose games like this, and until they do lose a game like this, I'm not going to sit here and tell anybody, much less you and your brilliant audience, that they're going to lose this game. The Packers are very good. Very good on both sides of the ball. Aaron Rodgers is a great quarterback. Having said that, the Steelers and their defense mainly, but also Roethlisberger, their quarterback, they just don't lose these games. And until I see it with my own two eyes, I'm telling you they're going to win this game too.
All right, I want to ask you a question just beyond your prediction. What would have to happen for you to be wrong?
Well, Green Bay would have to solve the Pittsburgh defense. The Pittsburgh defense, when Troy Polamalu, their NFL Defensive Player of the Year safety, when he plays, they only give up 14 points a game. Now, he's had some injuries over the years, and when he doesn't play, they give up 22. That's a pretty big difference. He's playing this weekend. He's healthy. So Green Bay will have to solve Pittsburgh with Polamalu. No one has done that, but Aaron Rodgers, look, he's only played 3 years as a starter. I'm telling you right now, he's a future Hall of Fame quarterback. He's that good. And maybe he turns this game into a pinball machine and lights up the Steelers. That's possible, but again, until I see it with my own eyes, I'm not going to predict it.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joined us from Dallas, the site of Super Bowl 45. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones hopes to cram more than 103,000 fans into his new stadium tomorrow, in addition to the 5,000 standing-room-only tickets that have already been sold for the plaza outside the stadium. In all, a record crowd of about 108,000 people will attend Super Bowl XLV, and the host committee has estimated that the event will generate more than $600 million for the North Texas region. Will it? Only a Game's Karen Given has our report.
Hello and welcome to Cowboys Stadium, home of your Dallas Cowboys.
Long before Arlington Mayor Bob Kluck ponied up $325 million in public funds to lure the Cowboys to his city, and before owner Jerry Jones spent $1.2 billion to build his 3 million square foot sports mecca, North Texans knew they were getting the Super Bowl. It was a bit of a if you build it, they will come scenario. Parking spots for the big game are selling for as much as $900, and a room at the Arlington Super 8 Motel could run you $699. Everyone's cashing in on the Super Bowl, which was, well, the whole point. It's late October, and nearly 1,000 people have gathered in Cowboys Stadium to have lunch with the likes of Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith, and to mark the 100-day countdown to the Super Bowl. Ask any of them what the big game will bring, and their eyes get wide with excitement. They're not sure about the specifics, but they're sure it'll be great. Let's start with Texas Governor Rick Perry.
The economic impact on the state is just, it's almost so big that you can't get your arms around it. But, of course, this is Texas, so we have the ability to get our arms around it. And it is a huge economic impact.
The North Texas Super Bowl Host Committee commissioned a report that says the region will see a $611 million windfall as a result of Sunday's game. But an independent study by PricewaterhouseCoopers put the Super Bowl effect at something closer to $200 million. And Robert Boddy, a sports economist at Lake Forest College, puts the real outcome much, much lower. Boddy says host committees forget to factor in things like tourists and convention goers who are crowded out during mega events like the Super Bowl, money that goes home with the players, team owners, and national hotel chains, and the costs the city bears in cleanup and safety.
So when you take all of those things into account, if you move that decimal point one place to the left, you're much closer to reality. So if you're talking about an NFL estimate of about $600 million as a consequence of the event, then the $60 million figure is likely to be far more representative of what we see.
Ann Boddy says that figure is giving the host committee every benefit of the doubt. The real figure might be closer to $30 million. But a one-time windfall isn't the only benefit North Texans hope to see from Super Bowl 45. Here's Cowboys owner Jerry Jones.
When this game is played, you probably will have the greatest audience that's ever been for this sporting event, of course. It'll be over 130, 40, 50 million people. Billion people up worldwide. And what that dog in the fight is for everybody in this room is we can showtime North Texas. We can showtime North Texas. All of this is going to be a whale of a way to say, hey, look us over. We're North Texas.
Ross Perot Jr., CEO of the Perot Group, goes even further, saying that the Super Bowl will convince decision makers around the world to move their businesses to North Texas. But Professor Boddy says corporate sponsors and business executives have much more tangible things to consider when setting up shop in a new town.
They're going to consider things like, is there a skilled labor force? They're going to consider things like the tax environment. They're going to consider things like the school system. There are all these other factors that are far, far more important for the bottom line than a Super Bowl or even the presence of a professional sports team.
But don't forget, Arlington, Texas isn't just the host of the 2011 Super Bowl. This fall, the World Series was played and lost at Rangers Ballpark in Arlington, just down the street from Cowboys Stadium, where, less than a year ago, the world record for attendance at a basketball game was shattered at the NBA All-Star Game. These three mega events, they've put Arlington on the map. At least, that's the way it seems to lifelong Arlington resident Orlando Sandoval.
When you go anywhere, you have to tell someone, oh, I'm from Dallas or I'm from Fort Worth, because nobody knows. We're on the spot now. We're in Arlington. We're main time in our own little town over here, Arlington, doing it right.
So how about it, Professor Boddy? Is there some sort of economic multiplier for a community that holds three mega events in a single year?
That's an interesting question. I think that if you don't find it for one, why would you necessarily find it for three? If they're expecting great things to happen, it's not likely to occur. And stadium environs, unless there's something real attractive in the immediate vicinity, the partying is likely to be transported to Dallas itself.
In other words, Super Bowl VIPs aren't going to be eating at the Chick-fil-A down the street from Cowboys Stadium. But not everyone's excitement is based solely on overinflated economic projections and dreams of financial windfall. Norma Hunt is the widow of Lamar Hunt, who owned the Kansas City Chiefs and is credited with giving the Super Bowl its name. Hunt has attended all 44 of the NFL's championship games, though she jokes that she must have been a child when the first Super Bowl was held. Her family still owns the Chiefs, but Hunt lives in North Texas, which makes this game special.
I am so excited. This is going to be the first Super Bowl that I do not have to fly to get there. So that will be so unusual to drive from my house to this game. Then we're just glad to have it here and show them some Texas hospitality.
And that's a benefit no economist in the world can deny. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Should you wish to view photos from Karen Given's trip to the Palace in Dallas, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Super Bowl tickets are scalped for tens of thousands of dollars. Parking close to the stadium will cost as much as $900. It's a high roller's lark. But Weta Wright of Green Bay, who has been homeless for 2 months, will be there too. She and her boyfriend Aaron acquired two tickets, hotel accommodations, and travel expenses by winning a contest sponsored by the Dallas Convention and Visitors Bureau, which awarded the prize to the first person to ask a designated mystery man, "Have you been to Dallas lately?" "We're lucky to get a can of soda or a movie," Ms. Wright said, "and now we're going to the Super Bowl." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of a young man who crossed the Mexican border for basketball. But first, 17 NFL seasons ago, in a small office that housed a fledgling public radio program about sports, three men wondered how that program should handle the Super Bowl. Just before they got desperate, or perhaps shortly after that happened, one of them tapped out on his keyboard the following. Blackbird, black on blue, dips above the quarterback, unconscious, twitching. Thus was born Super Bowl Haiku, or at least thus it was born as far as Only a Game is concerned. Now, hard as it may be to comprehend, it's time for Super Bowl Haiku XVII. Happily, over the years, listeners have contributed to the trove of haiku. Several of their efforts are included in this year's edition of the tradition. We'll mention their names at the end of the reading, unless they call before then and ask us, please, not to.
The whole world watches. Well, maybe not the whole world.
How about Djibouti?
Packs back, knack for sack, while fans snack may crack the back of Steelers attack.
Packers by 3 points? What? You think Roethlisberger's not quite all redeemed?
Green hopes in Green Bay. Black hearts of the dark Steelers.
Oh, that's just silly.
Does luck play a role?
Sure. Tom Brady's quite lucky. Home, watching with wife.
Vince Lombardi's wife sought a map to find Green Bay.
Found it. Bought some boots.
Cowboys at home muse. Would have been super home game. Were we any good?
Pats fans, baffled, whine.
Our team's better. We'd have won if we hadn't lost.
Bears, fearsome of late. Slumber, quiet in dark caves. Far from bright Dallas.
Lake bright green and white, the Empire State Building weeps. Oh, would if it could.
The Super Bowl shines with promise, like life.
At least until you get decked.
Football soars, wind blown, wobbles toward long stone fingers that don't know they're stone.
Red right,
comes the call.
Slant six, wait, that's an engine.
10 men think.
Uh-oh.
Pittsburgh may prevail. Green Bay, great once, grants nothing. Alliteration.
Arr! Oof! Mmm! Urg! Org! Wah! Ah-oo! Humma! Humma!
Sports, our religion. Super Bowl, our holy day. Cable goes out. Hail.
Super Bowl inspires waves of foaming sentiment. Marketing's high tide.
Bart Starr, Paul Hornung, Franco Harris, Mean Joe Green.
Doing other stuff.
Showdown 45. Fleet, swift Aaron, Big Ben looms like cheese against stainless.
Hype! Kickoff! Ads! Halftime! Ads! Final gun! Ads!
Kickers aren't players. Secretly, their teammates sneer. Until the last kick.
I to XLV. Does any player really go to Disneyland?
February bash. With any luck, when you wake, dirty snow is gone.
This year's Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players are Kirsten Kalkhurst, Walter Dixon, George Hicks, James Isaacs, Karen Given, Alistair Drummond, Clint Cavanaugh, Doug Trabu, and returning Haiku Hall of Famer Ted O'Brien, whom we were delighted to include this year. Special thanks also to our listeners who sent their poems. We read entries from Gloria Tanner, Amy Morton, Scott Suma, and Walt, no relation to Plaxico, Burris. As a teenager in Denver, Jorge Gutierrez, late of the state of Chihuahua in Mexico, played basketball at a high school that was 92% Hispanic. He depended on the school's free lunch program and the charity of strangers for his meals. Gutierrez is now a guard on the University of California Berkeley men's basketball team. On Thursday night, he led Cal with 18 points and 6 assists in a victory over Arizona State. Tonight, the unranked Golden Bears host number 22, Arizona. Jordan Kahn profiled Jorge Gutierrez for Sports Illustrated's website, SI.com. Jordan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Jorge Gutierrez was born in Mexico. Tell us about how he wound up playing his high school basketball in Denver.
Eduardo Nájera, who is an NBA player, 12 years in the NBA, emerged from Chihuahua and became the first Mexican to have sustained success in the NBA. Because of his success, other kids in Chihuahua started to really look up to him and want to emulate him. One player, a guy by the name of Hector Hernandez, went from Chihuahua to Denver. He was emerging from high school in Denver around the same time that Eduardo Nájera was playing for the Denver Nuggets. So Denver came to be seen by some of the basketball players in Chihuahua as this great place for Mexican basketball players. And so Jorge wanted to go there. And the way he tells it, it was entirely a basketball decision on his part. And he went as a 15-year-old with his parents. And his parents stayed with him for a short period of time in Denver. But then they returned to their lives in Mexico. And Jorge completed high school in Denver and then finished out in Las Vegas.
It would be an exaggeration to say that as a high school basketball player, Jorge Gutierrez was starving, but not much of an exaggeration, I guess.
After his parents left, he lived in a one-bedroom apartment with three other high school students, all between the ages of 14 and 16, all basketball players, all undocumented Mexican immigrants. They were relying on the money sent by their families who were living in Mexico. Jorge, at one point, coaches noticed him bruising all over his body. Just any contact would result in his joints kind of slipping and these enormous bruises showing up. And they had him checked out by a doctor, and he was anemic because of iron deficiency. The doctor asked him, "What have you been eating recently?" And he said that all he'd had to eat in the last several days was this head of wilted lettuce that they had in their refrigerator because it was summertime, so they didn't have the free lunch that they got at school.
These difficulties were somewhat shocking, I'm sure, because I gather Jorge Gutierrez had come from kind of a middle-class background in Mexico.
He had, yes. His father was a math teacher, and his mother was a retired nurse. He said that there were times that they struggled, but it was certainly not an impoverished life. And the way he put it was there was always food on the table.
So the idea wasn't to escape poverty. It was to get someplace where he could play against the best basketball players his age that there were.
Exactly. And, you know, interestingly, it's the way he talked about it was not even as if he was fixated on making the NBA or fixated on even earning a college scholarship. He said, quite simply, he just loved basketball. It was what he wanted to focus his life on, and he knew that he wasn't being challenged and wasn't being pushed in Mexico. And having heard about these opportunities in the States, he really wanted to be able to test himself.
Once he had begun to establish himself as a high school basketball star, Jorge Gutierrez drew a lot of attention, some of it angry. How did he manage to stay in the U.S.?
He drew some attention from people who were correctly, assuming that he was undocumented, and people who were protesting at some of his games. And the way his coaches and those who were there told it, any investigation never went beyond the statewide governing body for high school sports investigating his eligibility as a basketball player there.
Meaning his age, that sort
right.
of thing. Yeah.
Right. There was never any investigation by ICE or anyone into his immigration status. That was something that was never pressed.
Gutierrez eventually went on to lead Lincoln High to the Colorado State Championship, and then after a year at a Las Vegas prep school, he was recruited to play for Cal. There's been a lot of debate about whether students who lack immigration papers should be entitled to scholarship money. What's Jorge Gutierrez's current situation with regard to Cal?
He's here in the United States on a student visa, so he is treated as an international student.
You characterize Gutierrez's play with words like rage and, quote, sometimes unhinged. What provokes that anger, and does it hurt or help him on the court?
The man who Gutierrez considers his biggest mentor is Ray Valdez, who is an assistant coach at his high school. He described it just saying that he just has so much built-up anxiety and has you know some level of just fear that people are out to get him. And he very much plays with a chip on his shoulder and is very proud of the fact that he represents Mexico because Mexican basketball players are generally not highly thought of. As to how it affects his play, I think most people would say that it affects his play in a positive way just because he is so relentless on the court and just plays with reckless abandon and is flying all over the place, going for every loose ball, every rebound, is trying to be the best defender on the court at all times. But then there are times when he gets a little out of control, and I think that was seen most vividly this season in a game against Kansas in late December. Things were getting chippy between him and several of the Jayhawks players, and he sort of began to get into a bit of a tussle with a Kansas player. Was not ejected from the game, but people thought he perhaps should have been ejected from the game. And so there are moments when it kind of boils over, but for the most part, it's been a help, I think.
Gutierrez is averaging more than 12 points and 4 assists per game. The Golden Bears have won 4 straight games. They're still only 13-9 overall. Gutierrez is only a junior, but will he draw interest from the NBA when his college career ends?
At this point, I have not seen him showing up on these websites that kind of specialize in projecting NBA draft picks. Mm-hmm. But he certainly has the size and some of the skills to get a look. He's 6'3". He has good size for a point guard if he can really master the point guard position. He's an improving shooter and just a tenacious defender and rebounder. He has the skill set that seems like he could get a look and could certainly have opportunities to play at a high level in Europe, if not in the NBA.
Jordan Kahn's profile of Jorge Gutierrez was published on SI.com. You can find a link to it at our website, onlyagame.org. Jordan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game.
I am looking forward to this next chapter in my life, really, and figure out what that is. I'm going to watch my son play high school baseball, and I'm going to watch my daughter play volleyball.
When Andy Pettit, late of the Yankees, announced his retirement at a press conference in New York yesterday, it was easy to wish him well. It was also easy to understand how Pettit had come to feel that the time to leave baseball had arrived. Though he won 11 games against only 3 losses last season, he also spent 2 months on the disabled list. Over the course of his 16-year career, 13 of those seasons with the Yankees, Pettit won 240 games, 102 more than he lost, and he compiled an earned run average of 3.88. He helped the Yankees win 5 World Series titles, pitching the final game of the series in 1998 and again in 2009. But on the occasion of Andy Pettit's retirement, it's instructive to reflect on something other than his numbers. In 2007, Andy Pettit acknowledged that back in 2002, he had used human growth hormone in an effort to speed recovery from an injury. HGH was not banned by baseball until 2005, but in the context of the inquiry into the use of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball, Pettit decided to be forthright about how he had sought chemical help for his damaged elbow. With that decision, Andy Pettit separated himself from the ballplayers who lied about their use of various substances, and from the ballplayers who chose to say nothing at all, and from the ballplayers who have found themselves in and out of court for the past several seasons. Andy Pettit's decision made it possible for him to return to his day job with a minimum of fuss. Some people remember that Pettit's name surfaced in connection with the Mitchell investigation, but on the occasion of his retirement, fans are much more likely to be talking about his impressive baseball career than about public humiliation and charges of perjury. Though he no doubt wishes it were otherwise, Andy Pettit's retirement yesterday does not mean that he will have no further connection with baseball matters. This summer, he is expected to be a witness at the trial of one of his former teammates, Roger Clemens, who has been indicted on charges that he lied to a congressional committee when he denied using performance-enhancing drugs. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
It took Beth Johnson and her husband Tony 18 months of 7-hour days to build what they hoped would be the world's largest functioning yo-yo. In order to qualify for the record, the Johnson's 7,000-pound wooden toy would have to recoil at least 3 times, 2/3 of the way up the string, each time from a height of at least 75 feet. No problem, right? The Johnsons launched their 12-foot-wide yo-yo from a crane, at which point the rope supporting it burned through, sending the yo-yo crashing to the ground. The disappointed Beth Johnson said, "It didn't do what I thought it would do." And do the low. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a look at the brilliant, paranoid, and often controversial life of Bobby Fischer with the help of his biographer, chess authority Frank Brady. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The time has come for your annual invocation regarding tomorrow evening's attraction.
The Super Bowl is good.
Came out just exactly as I hoped it would, so thank you. It certainly is good to those who profit when lots of people are watching television. Last year's Super Bowl telecast set a record for viewers. That was 106.5 million of them. Does XLV do even better?
It could. You know, last year you had not only the star attraction of Peyton Manning, but also the redemption story of the New Orleans Saints, which was the feel-good story. If the NFL is capable of having a feel-good story, this is a feel-good story. I don't think the redemption story of Ben Roethlisberger quite comes up to that, to be perfectly honest with you. But these are two trademark franchises. They are two, in some sense, national franchises, maybe not in the sense of the Dallas Cowboys or the Oakland Raiders, but still, you know, two brand names going back to the dim times of the 1920s. So I think they'll be right around that number or maybe just a little bit above it.
A not-so-new idea is getting a groundswell of support on Facebook, Charlie. A number of groups are proposing that the Super Bowl should be moved to Saturday so that fans can better indulge without negatively affecting productivity on Monday. And by groundswell, I mean to say the idea has gotten a few hundred supporters and an article on SI.com. What do you think about Super Bowl Saturday?
I think it's one time of the year where we don't worry about productivity like we're a bunch of gears in a wheel. I'm perfectly willing to leave it where it is.
In college football news, Floyd Raven's mom forged her son's name on a letter of intent, and then apparently she also sent the letter to the wrong college. Floyd and his mom want to talk more often.
From her standard, she really wanted. What happened was he left the letter of intent at home, and his mom sent it in, hadn't realized that her son had changed his mind and wanted to go to Texas A&M, sent the letter of intent to the University of Mississippi, and she wanted him to go there. I don't think this is an accident,
all
by
right,
the way.
Maybe not. But to Mississippi's credit, they said, hey, if the kid doesn't want to come here, then it's all right.
What the heck? We'll recruit his mom.
Charlie, we spoke previously about the 13 University of Iowa football players who had been hospitalized with a rare muscle disorder after, quote, intense winter workouts. Now several hospital workers have been fired or otherwise disciplined in connection with the release of the news about those players. Coach Kirk Ferentz is still employed at Iowa, I assume?
He is. And yes, if these people released confidential medical data, they should be fired. I mean, there are two separate issues here.
Bad idea to do that,
obviously. The other thing that's going on is, and I said this last week, and I hope that the University of Iowa is keeping this investigation out of the hands of the athletic department, because it certainly seems like these kids were overworked.
Lane Kiffin is still employed as well. His former employer, the University of Tennessee, will apparently be cited by the NCAA for, quote, failure to monitor during Kiffin's one-year tenure. The NCAA will also cite Kiffin, who now coaches at USC, a program which has NCAA problems of its own because of the guy who used to coach there. Any chance Kiffin's new employer decides it's really not worth the effort to keep him around?
It's interesting. I don't know what's going to – that's a good question, because I don't know how big this whole thing at Tennessee is going to be. USC does not need another fistfight with the NCAA. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they started looking sideways at their current head coach.
I certainly hope, Charlie, that you tuned in to the Bruins-Stars game on Thursday night, or that at least you were watching for the first 4 seconds of said game. Do you want to take us through that?
I thought I was watching security video from the parking lot. There were three fights in the first 4 seconds of the game, and it was a pretty good game. It was a 6-3 win by the Bruins. It was an awfully good hockey game once they got the pregame festivities out of
maybe
the way.
Maybe that was the theory, because I hate it when a good hockey game is interrupted by a wrestling match with guys pulling each other's sweaters. Maybe they thought we'll get it all out of the way in the first 4 seconds, and then we'll have a hockey game.
That's not a bad theory, and you know what? If the NHL were to follow this, I might soften my stance on fighting in hockey.
The NHL suspended Bruins forward Daniel Paille for 4 games for a blindside hit on Stars forward Raymond Sawada in that same game. Sawada has a broken nose and a sprained shoulder. Is the NHL making the right choice by stopping blindside hits but allowing these kind of fights we're talking about?
Well, yeah, because I don't think anyone ever gets hit and gets concussions and loses their careers in one of these fights. Paille's was a blindside hit, which is why the NHL started looking at it up close and personal. Suspension's probably the right thing to do.
We're into February,
yes,
which means the TV promotions for March Madness have already begun for an event that doesn't actually end until April. But okay, have you any wisdom to offer regarding teams that we're likely to see in the last couple of rounds of the big basketball tournament?
Yeah, Ohio State is every bit as good as their record looks. Jared Sullivan is a terrific player, as is the freshman Josh Selby at Kansas, who will not be on campus at Kansas University 23 seconds after the Jayhawks get eliminated in the NCAA tournament, whenever that is. The Big East Conference is absolutely loaded. Pittsburgh's their highest-ranked team at 4, but they've got a whole bunch of teams in the top 20. And the other thing that's really interesting about this season, Bill, is that there is no Butler. There are no mid-majors making that kind of noise. You're looking at, I believe, a Final Four from the power conferences this year.
Labor relations, always a big deal in sports, Charlie, as they are in our country's steel mills. What do you make of management's latest demand of the Pittsburgh area U.S. steel workers?
They have to come to work Sunday or Monday, and if they miss it without cause, they will face, quote, severe disciplinary action. Remember what I said before about one day a year where we don't have to be cogs in the big wheel? This is what I was talking about. I am terribly sorry, but U.S. Steel should be embarrassed for this.
Now, this is reminding me of the great line from A Christmas Carol. It's only one day a year, sir.
Yeah, it's a poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 24th of December.
And finally, Charlie, given what a pain in the neck, back, and shoulders all this snow has been, I think we should give credit to Boston.com for creating a fun take on the growing drifts. Do you like the way they're measuring snowfall?
Yes, we have nearly an entire Shaquille O'Neal's worth of snow out there this year. He is 7'1", or 85 inches. We've had 70.5 inches of snow this year. And so we haven't nearly an entire shack of snow.
And I can't see the window from here, so I don't know if, as you speak, more is falling. But I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Charlie Fierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?
Early in his life, Bobby Fischer achieved an impressive number of distinctions. He was the first chess player as young as 13 years and 4 months to achieve the rank of master. At 14, he became the youngest player ever to win the U.S. Open chess tournament, and at 15, he became the youngest grandmaster in the world. He achieved fame and notoriety beyond the world of chess in 1972 when he defeated Boris Spassky and became his game's world champion. In Endgame, subtitled Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness, Frank Brady explores the life of the exceptional and sometimes repellent Fischer. Frank Brady joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for inviting me.
In Endgame, you discuss at length Bobby Fischer's triumphs as a very young player. Did you get the sense of what particular qualities enabled him to become so proficient so early at chess?
Well, first of all, he was probably the foremost student of the game that has ever lived. As a child, he dedicated himself to reading every chess book that was in the Brooklyn Public Library, and there were hundreds. He taught himself languages like Russian and Serbo-Croatian and others so that he could read foreign chess publications and follow the games. The other part of it is that he did have an astronomical IQ. It was 180. He could seek patterns. He saw patterns. He could look very deeply into a particular position. I think most people look one or two moves ahead. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you can see three or four moves ahead. He could look as high as 20 moves ahead, or sometimes more. And then he also had a tremendous passion for the game. Mm. He loved it. He once said, chess is life, and that's what it was for him.
Tell me a little bit about how the chess establishment in New York and Brooklyn and elsewhere came to realize Bobby Fischer's gifts.
Well, first of all, we saw the way that he played and his concentration and his seriousness involved in the game. At first, nobody thought he was going to become champion of the world, but he really caught on after a while and started slaying dragons. I mean, he was winning game after game, tournament after tournament as a child. But then at the Marshall Chess Club, he played a game that was later referred to as the game of the century. It was so brilliant, and he looked so deeply, and it was so daring that it really has never been matched in chess since then, and that's over 50 years ago. And it was published all over the world, and even the Russians sat up. Chess was certainly the national pastime in Russia. As he began to play, people said, well, who is this nobody playing and beating the U.S. Open champion? That really accented his growth.
You say he was a child playing that game. Do you remember precisely how old he was?
He was about 13.
Wow. Yeah. The famous match in Iceland against Boris Spassky in 1972 is memorable for Fischer's triumph, of course, but it's perhaps as memorable for the series of delays that he caused, the string of demands that he imposed on the organizers of the match. Did this behavior result from Bobby Fischer's need to be the center of attention even when he wasn't actually playing chess?
I don't think it had anything to do with him wanting to be the center of attention. He actually despised publicity. He felt that as long as he held out, that the prize fund would be raised, and by God, it was. And all of a sudden, instead of people playing for the world's championship for a few thousand dollars, they were playing for $250,000. So that was part of it. The other part of it is that Bobby looked upon chess as a concert pianist looks upon playing a sonata on the stage of Carnegie Hall. Everything had to be right. You couldn't sit near him. You couldn't make noise. You couldn't have television or still cameras clicking away to disturb him. He wanted everything to be precise. And if he didn't have it, he just wasn't going to play.
Bobby Fischer provided lots of reasons for refusing to defend the championship that he won in 1972. What seemed to you to be the most convincing of those reasons?
Well, the convincing reason was that he wanted something like 139 different things done, and the World Chess Federation agreed to like 138 of them. He felt that if he made a demand, that was it. So was it unreasonable? Maybe, but he did, in reality, elevate the game because now prizes are higher, conditions are so much better, lighting is so much better. There's not that much noise anymore in tournaments so that the great players can play in complete confidence.
In the subtitle of the book, you characterize Bobby Fischer as, quote, falling to the edge of madness. But this is a man who publicly and continuously denied that the Holocaust had happened, a man who celebrated the 9/11 attacks in a radio broadcast, more than once, actually, a man who eventually came to believe that virtually everybody he'd ever befriended and who had befriended him was plotting against him. Doesn't that sound like madness rather than the edge of madness?
Well, it's a very delicate distinction. Bobby was certainly paranoid. The anti-Semitic statements that he made, the anti-American statements that he made, was undeniably, they were obscene, they were outrageous, they were not acceptable. They were awful. I interviewed a psychiatrist in Iceland who was with Bobby during the 3 years that he lived there. He was not treating Bobby. He was a friend of Bobby's and a very honest and reliable person, Dr. Magnus Skulason. And he said, as far as he was concerned, he was not psychotic and he was not schizophrenic. He was paranoid and he was a deeply disturbed and troubled man. So that's about as far as I can go with it.
As you mentioned, Bobby Fischer spent the last few years of his life in Iceland, and you characterize Iceland as, quote, a country that really wanted Bobby Fischer, one of the few. Yet at the end of his life, you write that Fischer regarded all Icelanders as, quote, cheaters and betrayers. What brought him to that conclusion?
Well, the best quote I think I can give you that Bobby ever said that explains him is at one point he said, I am always on the attack. Always on the attack. He didn't just mean on the chessboard. He meant in every situation. It's possible that a lifetime of chess, when you have to be attacking, sort of molded him into that. But no matter how well you befriended him, no matter what you did for him, eventually he would find a way to dispute you. If you were in a room with him having a conversation, he would find a way to get into an argument. And not just an argument, it would be an attack. He was not a pleasant person, for the most part, to be with, I can tell you.
You suggest at the end of your book that Fischer's legacy, and I'm quoting now, for the world may simply be the awe that his brilliance evoked. Is that his legacy as far as you're concerned?
That's his legacy as far as chess players are concerned. Perhaps to the general public, his legacy is one of hate. Bobby Fischer was truly the greatest chess player that ever lived. And his games sparkle with brilliancy and sometimes even with humor, with depth, with poetry. Playing over a Bobby Fischer chess game, if you are a dedicated chess player, can bring tears to your eyes. They're so beautiful. So to me, I think of Bobby as a great chess player and a greatly failed human being who had tumbled from grace.
Frank Brady, the president of the Marshall Chess Club, is the author of Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall from America's brightest prodigy to the edge of madness. The book is published by Crown. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Brady, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filipino. Special thanks to the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players and to our legion of listener poets. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from ace haiku reader Walter Dixon.
Packers by 3 points? What? You think Roethlisberger is the last of the I can't put you for sure.
Now, to be fair, Walter read that poem at our training camp a few weeks before haiku season had begun, and Only a Game's crack staff of poetry coaches got him into shape just in time for the real thing. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.